Morning, everybody. Matt Pubala here with you on 720 WGN 222 as we get out of the news. David, you get a second to catch your breath, and then we'll be back for the 230 news in just a couple of minutes.
Okay.
David Jennings filling in for Roger Badish. I think Roger's at a wedding tonight, right, Jess?
Isn't that what Roger says? I believe he is.
He had a wedding to go to for one of the former producers here, Cody Gaw. Or no, a current producer here, Cody Gaw. Is getting married tonight, I think that's the story. I don't want to misrepresent anything, but Roger away for the night, but David Jennings is ably filling in for us all night long, all the way through 5 a.m., or do you go even later, David?
Nope, 5:30.
5:30, nice. Okay. So, lots to do tonight, coming up right after the 2:30 news. As we mentioned, Mike Kinch will be on the phone with us. He is an urban explorer here in Chicago. Thank you, Patty. He's only 19, but he does things like break into abandoned hospitals or silos and take pictures. And they are fascinating pictures. I've seen this over the years in many places when people go into like the Chernobyl zone that's still dead to everything, or there's abandoned amusement parks that have just been sitting out in the elements for years. It really produces startling, stark images that are really cool. However, it's very dangerous, and an urban explorer died earlier this week. He was on a ledge at the London House here on the corner at Michigan Avenue and Wacker, and fell to his death. So it's very dangerous, too. There's a big story about it in the Chicago Tribune today. And Mike, who was featured on that, will jump on the phone with us to talk about why he does it and the photos he gets and whether or not he, you know, is a little risky in the behavior and takes too many chances. The headline says, mass hysteria may explain the sonic attacks in Cuba, according to a neurologist, one of whom we will speak with at 3 a.m. And then, as we said, we'll talk about the airline shortage, the pilot shortage that's going on, not only in the Navy, but with the commercial airlines. They need more pilots. And it's something that if you ever thought you might want to do, now might be a good time to do it. So 312-981-7200 is the number. We'll take your calls and texts all night long as well here on 720 WGN. Hey! 312-981-7200 is the number. Listen, I really do hope that the Bulls have a good season. I do. I root for our Chicago teams, and they're embracing it just the way Theo did 5-6 years ago, and look at where it got the Cubs. 3 straight NLCS series, 1 World Series championship. I'm bummed that the Cubs are done playing. I am not going to complain one bit about it, though. Let's face it. These are the 3 best baseball years of my 45 years as a Cubs fan. So I'm cool with it all. And I hope that they retool and there's a lot of things that need to be done. And I hope they're back next year. But there was a point where I didn't think they'd get out of the NLDS. So 5 games of the NLCS I will take all day long. Coming up after the news, Mike Kinch is going to jump on the phone with us. We'll talk about urban exploration. First, it's 2:30 in the morning. Let's get upstairs and check the news headlines. Here's David Jennings. Hold on. I'm doing something here. Listen to this. This is an ad for Burger King. Have you seen this tonight, David Jennings?
Please stop.
Fine.
Dude, ow.
Fine.
Stop.
Fine.
Ow, stop.
Do you have any friends?
Yes, I heard you.
Burger King.
What are you even doing here?
Put cameras in their restaurants.
Stop.
And in front of real customers,
come on.
They had kids bullying another high school kid, picking on him. Spilling drinks on his food, pushing him around, teasing him. Don't you have any friends? At the same time, they've got cameras in the back. When people order a junior Whopper, this guy is bullying the burger. He's beating it up. He's pushing it around. And then they serve it to him. Then they open it up, and their burger looks like it was beat to hell.
Dude, stop.
It's a mess. So while this kid's getting bullied, and basically nobody is saying anything in the restaurants, they're walking up with this burger like, hey, what the hell is this burger? I ordered a burger.
Hi, how's it going?
I was given this.
Did you bully this burger?
Well, yeah. This is a defenseless Whopper Jr. It can't defend itself.
You don't mean anything by it.
It's just for
laughs. It's just for laughs.
Just give me my f***ing burger, man.
What the f*** is going on here?
What are you? Is there something wrong with you?
Because that's clearly what happened.
95% of the customers who got a bullied burger came
had
up and complained.
Had you seen me bullying this burger, would you have stood up and said something?
Yeah.
It's good to know.
12% of the customers who saw the kid being bullied said anything.
I'm not surprised.
Are you okay?
Yeah, I'm okay.
Yeah?
And it's just heartwarming. This woman stops these kids and then walks over and sits with the kid.
Iris.
We're just having fun.
You having fun? He's not having fun. So therefore, I think you guys should just leave him alone.
Later. This feels better to me.
Have you ever been, like, messed with before?
Oh, my God. This is, like, the ideal world is where if somebody else sees, like, something weird happening, that they'll come over and be like, hey, this is not okay.
Yeah.
To feel defenseless, that's the one of the worst things in the world.
Chelsea came, and she would just tell them that it's not okay.
Because it isn't.
Something I'll never forget is my friend standing up for me.
I've been that kid, so if I see it, I'm gonna do something about it. You know?
So it's just it's being passed around virally. We'll put it up on the Matt Bubala Show Facebook page. Give my page a like on Facebook, and we'll share that there. It's very powerful, and it's cool. But all I can think is, great that Burger King did it, but 12% of your customers said something? That's it? 95% of people complain about their stupid burger, which you would complain if you saw these burgers. The guy was beating the snot out of them. I mean, you're opening this thing up going, did this fall on the floor? Did somebody step on this? What the hell happened here? So I'm not surprised people said something about their burger. But they're doing it at the same time that they're walking by this kid being pushed around, not physically hurt, but like they're teasing him out loud so you can hear it. They're dumping his Coke. They're, you know, just doing stuff, and barely anybody said anything.
This is a sad example of human nature, because we can see something right in front of our faces that we know is dead wrong, but we won't say anything about it.
Yeah.
We will see people who are victims of not just bullying, but of just general abuse, physical, sexual, a la Harvey Weinstein. And instead of accepting that what they're being told is the truth, oh, well, are you sure that's what happened? You sure you didn't encourage him in some way or encourage her in some way? You know, it's our national pastime. Let's minimize the problem. It's really not that bad. I don't want to get involved. It's not my problem. I don't want to get my hands dirty. What if I'm wrong? What if it's not what it appears to be?
As I'm watching it the first time, and they say that 12% of their customers did anything, I'm thinking, I wonder if Burger King and Wendy's or McDonald's and Wendy's are like, well, you know what? At least 20% of ours would have done something. I wonder if that badly reflects on people who are going to Burger King. Like, you know,
I don't think it's a reflection on Burger King customers.
Sure,
I think it's a reflection just on us as people.
It is. It is. And that's pretty powerful stuff being passed around. By the way, I just want to say one thing. I was laughing pretty hard at the Bulls WGN TV commercial because they're saying a new era, because they're trying to sell this. It's a rebuilding era. They're working from the ground up. We'll see what happens. Neil Funk and Stacey King are still worth watching the games for, even if the games are good. It reminds me of when Ronnie Santo was calling the games here at WGN with Pat Hughes. And even when we had some really, really, really awful Cub seasons, Ron and Pat would make it interesting. Neil Funk and Stacey King together are quite a tandem, and they make everything interesting. And so whether or not the Bulls can get much done this year or not, it will be worthwhile to watch those guys and listen to those guys call the game. So make sure you tune in tonight, 6:30 at WGN TV. By the way, so I'm looking up a list of Bulls announcers. There's a Wikipedia page of the Bulls announcers over time. Did you know that in 1979, 1980, Bob Costas did play-by-play of the Bulls on WGN TV? I never knew that. Says 1979 to 1980, Bob Costas.
Really?
Yeah. Milo Hamilton from 85.
This was well before he was at the network level.
Oh, yeah,
right?
I'm sure it
was. He was on his way up.
Yeah, he was a young thing back then. I mean, that's 37 years ago. So
yeah,
Bob's got to be 60,
is much older.
65, right?
He's older than he looks.
Yeah, well, good work will do that.
Yeah.
He's probably, what would you guess, around 65-ish?
I would say he's probably in his 60s.
Yeah.
By now.
Let's see. It says born. He is exactly 65. Ha ha. March 22nd, 1952.
Yeah, he's he's been, you know, I mean, I grew up with a generation before him, which would include, this is how it goes, Sal speaking of sports, you know, that group. So he was the tail end of them.
Yeah.
And, you know, him, Al Michaels.
Who's still around.
Yes.
Doing it.
John,
doing well.
I miss John Madden.
Yeah, John Madden was fun on football.
He and Pat Summerall were like the perfect football announcers. Absolute perfection. Although Madden did have one little quirk, he wouldn't fly.
Yeah, that's right. He had to take the bus all around the country.
Yep.
How did he handle that when he was coaching? Because they were already flying, I'm sure, when he was coaching the Raiders. And being on the West Coast like that, that's like if they had to play against the Jets, what would he do?
I don't know, but
I wonder if he flew back then because he had to.
I have a newsflash for you.
Uh-oh.
Guess who's older than Bob Costas? Al Michaels.
Oh, I'm sure he is. Al Michaels is probably in his mid-70s, isn't he?
72.
Yeah. I thought he was going to be even older than that, quite honestly. So Costas was 28 the 1 year he did the Bulls games. John Paxson did a year. I forgot that John Paxson did color analyst for a year, 1998 to 1999. That was, the first year after Jordan left for good, right? When he retired the second time. I think 97-98 was the Bulls' last championship, wasn't it? That's just interesting to think about that. Bob Costas doing the games, being followed by Milo Hamilton. So that must have been quite a change in broadcast announcing styles to go from a year of Costas to Milo Hamilton after that. And Milo wrote it out. So Milo was 1980 to 1985. And so did he catch the very beginning of the Jordan era then? Was Jordan drafted like in 83? Because the Bulls won their first championship in when? 98 was their last one, right? So it was 98, 97, 96. Didn't win 95, 94, 1, 93, 92, 91. I think that's the case. How many years was Michael in the league? So maybe Michael came in 86, 87.
Oh, and Madden isn't afraid to fly. He's claustrophobic.
Well, that's interesting.
And he did. Apparently, he did fly when he was the head coach of the Oakland Raiders.
Yeah. Yeah, he had to have. That would be too impossible. So that's interesting. He's claustrophobic. Now, I know they had a big RV set up for him that traveled around the country and stuff,
customized bus.
I'm sorry,
you know.
That's fear of flying. That's not claustrophobia. You could say, oh no, it's that I'm claustrophobic. But if you ask me, they would have rented him a nice big plane and he'd be all himself in there. Or is it just, can claustrophobia be locked in something I can't get out of? Because I guess a plane, you know, a bus, he could always say, pull over, I need to step out. So you have that option. On a plane, you don't get that option. And so you could say, well, it's claustrophobia. But to me, that's fear of flying. You're afraid to be up in the sky where you can't get out. I think you could characterize that maybe as claustrophobia, but I think that's his way of saying, I'm not afraid to fly. David, your thoughts?
I'm not sure I have any yet. I'm really not. I mean, you know,
I think that's a perfect standalone drop. David, your thoughts? I'm not sure I have any yet.
You know, I mean, I've flown before. You know, the longest flight I've ever taken was from New York to Rio de Janeiro.
Okay.
And that was a very long time ago. But I don't like flying in coach. I hate it with a bloody passion. I'm not a tiny guy, 6 feet. And, you know, as I've gotten older, I kind of expanded a little, just a tad, you know. And it's like coach seats were designed for models.
Well, especially these days. I mean,
they're not designed for real people.
In the years that Madden used to fly in the 70s, there was a lot more space in coach than there is now.
Now it's like, okay, here's a shoehorn. Let me help you sit.
Now it's sausage tight.
And I'm like, you know, if I really had a job where I had to fly, it would be a requirement. It's business class or first class. I will not fly coach.
Yeah.
Period.
Well, even, you know, I don't fly a ton, but I fly for business a number of times a year. And I buy now there's packages you could buy. So I fly exclusively with United because I try to build up the miles. And there are packages you could buy to avoid the fees all the time. You could buy a baggage package where you get two bags for free every time instead of paying it. And
that's – you know what?
I know it's frustrating, but
– that's just silliness. You know?
It saves me money by doing that. And there's also an Economy Plus package you could buy. So I buy that for the year because flying in coach now, you can't even open your laptop. If somebody leans back at all,
you're done.
You're done. There's nothing you're done. You can't even hold up the – at my age, you can't hold the paper up where you can hold it far enough away that you can read it. So I have to – buy that package.
You may need glasses.
No, I don't. My arms are plenty long enough.
Okay, fine.
When I get to the point that my arms can't get far enough away for me to read, then I need glasses. That's why God gave you arms, so you know when you need glasses. Your arms don't do it anymore.
Your logic is just simply fascinating. I don't know where you got it from.
That's why we're having a sociologist on later. A neurologist. Whatever.
You need a vacation.
A vacation would be nice.
A little time away from the giggly Brooks home for the none too tightly wrapped.
Something like that. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Our urban explorer is either out urban exploring or at 19, the kid can't hack it till 2:30 in the morning. What's his problem, Jess? Where is this guy? Mike, where are you? Maybe he's in a, maybe he broke into some abandoned mental institution. He's taking pictures.
Maybe that's what he's doing. Maybe that's why he's not answering my phone calls right now.
All right. Well, we will try again next week with the urban explorer. See if, tell him he's got to come down now. Now he's got to come in next week. If he wants this, he's got to come in. Because I want him to come in and show us some of the pictures, quite honestly. I think that would be fun. And then maybe we could post them online. 312-981-7200. If you want to jump in, we got a phone line open. Call us, 720-WGN. Matt Bubala with you, 720-WGN. Jess, will you and Stefan go out for Halloween? Do you guys still dress up? You're a young, unengaged yet, as of yet, couple. Although, what did you just post? Are you guys celebrating an anniversary?
Yes.
How many years?
Just one.
One full year. You put up a nice little montage of all the cute pictures of you two together. It was totes adorbs.
I actually asked him to do like a cute little couples thing for Halloween, like couples costumes.
And he said there's no chance.
And he said no.
You need to remind him of who is the boss, and it's you.
Well, you know what? It's an interesting thing, David. I think there's a difference between old married couples and young single couples. And here's where I'm going to project here. Here's where Jess is at. Jess is hoping to get engaged sometime soon. And this is a really painted generalization, but I'm going to say this, Jess, and you can yell at me if I'm wrong. Before they're engaged and married, the women don't let us realize how in charge they are of our lives. Then once we're engaged, once we're married, then the pretense is off and it's like, well, no, I'm controlling things here. You realize that, right? Is that fair, Jess?
Maybe.
If you guys were married, you'd tell him, no, we are going as a couple. This is the costume we're doing. And he'd say, yes, dear. But since there's no ring on that finger, he can still feel like, hey, yeah, no, I'm not doing that. And just like, all right, I'll let that slide, but I'm going to remember that.
I have a tally.
There's a sheet with his name on it. Okay, so you guys are not going as a couple, but you guys are going to some party? You're doing something fun?
Well, we are actually having a party at our house.
You're hosting a party?
Mm-hmm.
Huh, that's interesting. You would think invitations to that have probably already gone out.
That's true. There was a Facebook invite.
You did not send it to me.
I'm not the one creating the party.
Oh, don't start now with now I have no control over this stuff. Nice try. That's okay. I know I'm old and not in your friend age group, so we wouldn't be invited. That's fine by us.
Matt, I'm cordially invited.
Whatever.
You.
It's so too late. I'm sorry. We have plans. What day is it on? Well, we still have plans. But here's the thing. I imagine you don't do this, Jess, but the whole sexy costume thing is, I think it's more show than anything else. Do younger women really, there's a list of the worst sexy costumes out this year. And when you go into the costume stores, as we do for the kids every year, you see all of these. And it's not just what you would expect, like the, I don't know, the French handmaids.
The naughty nurse.
The naughty nurse, the French maid, whatever. Now, like any costume there is, there's like a weird sexy version of. So here's a list from Yahoo of the worst sexy costumes. Freddy Krueger, the Tin Man, Strawberry Shortcake, Minions. So you take a nice, wholesome, cute kids thing and you turn it into a cleavage-bearing, high-skirted thing. It just seems odd. The Northern Queen. So that's a Game of Thrones takeoff. That makes sense. I could see that. This one I don't get. Doggy Doo. And that is a character, I believe, like a cousin of Scooby-Doo. So it's this weird, really skimpy, like really insanely skimpy sort of dog costume. Called Doggy Doo. There is a sexy adult criminal investigator CSI costume. So it's like a jumpsuit with a tool belt that says CSI on it where you can expose a ton of cleavage. Why would you be a sexy adult crime scene investigator? Why would you do that?
It's the planning for a new CSI, okay?
CSI After Dark.
No, CSI Hot.
There is the sexy remote control, which doesn't make any sense. And the remote control on the costume honestly looks like it's from the 1980s.
Yeah, but what did they design that remote control in the costume to actually control?
Well, that's a good question. Plus, basically, that woman will be sexually harassed the entire night because her costume is made up of buttons. Not actual buttons coming off, but it's painted on like it looks like a bunch of buttons, which means people are going to get drunk and come up and go, power this on, and touch her.
Uh-huh.
The Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle sexy costume looks really weird. The sexy Darth Vader.
Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle sexy. Has a sexy
yes,
costume?
It does. There's a sexy Darth Vader. There's a sexy Pikachu. A sexy Iron Man. A sexy Lady Jack Skellington from Nightmare Before Christmas.
Okay.
I hope I don't get in trouble, but I was Googling some of these as you're talking about them.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them are kind of interesting. I think I would do the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles just because
that one looks so weird, though, doesn't it? It looks like a Viking queen in neon green.
There are a couple here. This one just looks like a full-on onesie, which is pretty awesome.
Which one?
I found one from Party City. It is $49.99, in case anyone else was wondering.
That's the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles?
Yeah, it's just like a jumpsuit, which is like the shell body.
There is a Transformers Bumblebee sexy costume, a sexy adult poison apple body shaper costume. Which means they can't use the trademark name Snow White, I guess. So they call it the adult poison apple body shaper costume. So you can be a sexy Snow White, a sexy Ghostbuster, a sexy Beetlejuice, a sexy, it says adult American Dream, it's takeoff of Captain America, which they can't use, and a sexy Fairyland leader costume. So it's basically a... what was the fairy? Is Pinocchio? Who did Kathy Rigby play forever and ever, David? It wasn't Pinocchio, was it? Is that Pinocchio?
Kathy Rigby?
Yeah, remember she would go on tour every year as
Peter Pan.
Peter Pan. There's a sexy Peter Pan costume. The other weird Halloween controversy this week was there was an Anne Frank costume out this year. And it wasn't like a sexy Anne Frank costume, because that really would have been weird. But just an Anne Frank costume was being marketed. It's been pulled, I understand,
yep.
I read. But it's
it
like,
has.
What? I mean, to honor Anne Frank, to emulate Anne Frank, but Halloween is not a time that we generally do that. So that just seems doggone weird. All right, let's catch up on the break and then get to the news next. 720 WGN. Matt Bubala here with you on 720 WGN. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. Let's talk about these, what happened in Cuba. The diplomats have been pulled because of these supposed sonic attacks. We have gotten very little information about this, and possibly because it's really not understood what happened. Joining us on the phone right now is Robert Bartholomew. He's an American-born medical sociologist, writer, journalist, human rights advocate. I could go on and on and on in his bio, but we'll just jump on the phone and chat with him. Hey, Robert, how are you this morning?
How's it going?
Going well. Where are you located at right now?
Right now, I grew up in upstate New York,
and now
I am in Auckland, New Zealand.
How does a kid from upstate New York end up in Auckland, New Zealand?
I don't know. That's a good question. I'm teaching down here. It's a beautiful place, and it reminds me of upstate New York.
Was it just one of those things that life takes you on weird twists and turns, and one job led to another, and suddenly you're in New Zealand, or is it a chance to see the world and see other cultures and live in other places that took you there?
A and B. I'd say both of the above.
Okay. Fair enough. All right. Let's talk a little bit about what, and thank you very much for jumping on the phone with us. We love guests from Auckland, New Zealand, because it's a great time for them to be on the radio at 3 a.m. in Chicago. So these sonic attacks in Cuba, there's the story explains that instead of a sonic attack or something that we still don't understand, that it could be something like a mass hysteria. Explain to me what that means.
Well, you know, this report that's coming out of Cuba from the State Department, it's very confusing. There are indications that it's continuing and then it stops and it's continuing again. When you talk about mass hysteria, aka mass psychogenic illness, it's kind of like the placebo effect in reverse. You can make yourself sick. You can also make yourself well with a placebo effect. It works in reverse. It's the power of the mind. And when you look at this case from afar, it looks for all the world that it's real. I mean, 22 American diplomats so far have been affected since last December. There have been a number of diplomats from Canada as well reportedly affected. And the State Department says it's true. And when you look at the symptoms, there's a whole bunch of symptoms, but they also include brain trauma and permanent hearing loss. And certainly brain trauma and permanent hearing loss are not psychogenic psychological symptoms. And so when you look at it, it's like there's no way it can be mass hysteria. But when you look at it closer, it all falls apart and unravels. And the only plausible explanation is mass psychogenic illness. I do not believe the government. I'm not one of these conspiracy theorists or anything like that. But when you have a situation like this, you need to very closely follow the facts, not as you hope that they're going to be or think they are, but as they are. And right now, I'm very suspicious because the government hasn't really released any supporting information whatsoever. Have you heard the sound that's been released?
I saw that that has been released, but no, I have not heard the sound.
It sounds like, I mean, the government came out with this recently. The Associated Press got a hold of it and released it. And it's kind of like saying, well, you're not saying it's real. Here's the sound. Okay. And it sounds like a band of high-pitched cicadas.
Mm-hmm.
It's an irritating, whining sound. And I would say it's the audio equivalent of the fuzzy Bigfoot photo. It means nothing. It could be anything. Just to have a sound. So they say things like, well, there's verified brain trauma. And they asked them to clarify that. What do you mean by that? Because that's not really a medical term. And they said, well, it's something like a concussion, but it's not a concussion. When they say hearing loss, is it permanent? How many people have lost their hearing? Is it 17? Is it one? Why haven't they released that information? If it's 17, why don't you come out and say, well, 17 people have reported hearing loss, and you don't have to give up the names of the people. Just look at the medical records and give us the symptoms. And most of these symptoms, I mean, fatigue, insomnia, headaches, dizziness, I have probably half of those every week. They're very common symptoms. And experts in acoustics have said that there's no sonic device in the world that can cause brain trauma. It's just not possible through the known laws of physics. If you try to focus a device on a building, 99% of the waves are going to bounce off anyway. And I've gotten kind of hate mail from people saying, well, you've claimed that it's mass psychogenic illness, but the military has these devices and secret machines that they developed that could cause these. No, they don't. It's, you know, classic conspiracy theories and stuff like that. If they have these devices, how come they weren't using them to clear people in Raqqa and in these places in the Middle East where they're having all kinds of problems?
Yeah, you'd think if we have this technology, there'd be places we'd be using it to disperse people or to, you know, get in places where we don't want to drop bombs or shoot people or something like that, right?
Yeah, and, you know, the strange thing about this is, it's not really the embassy. When you look at it more closely, it's people, they've reported having heard these sounds and feeling unwell in hotels. They've had the same thing in their homes. And a person has said, and there's been a number of these reports where they say, well, I was in the hotel and I felt unwell and I heard this noise. Okay. But there's a person standing right next to him that didn't feel unwell. It's just very vague. And what I find fascinating here is we've kind of been down this road before. And the road is about 190 miles from Chicago, Illinois. And that is in the 1980s and 1990s, in Kokomo, Indiana, they had the famous Kokomo hum scare.
I don't know about the famous Kokomo hum scare. This is the first I've heard of the Kokomo hum scare. Okay, tell us about this.
Well, it really started in 1999 in Kokomo, but there's other places where they've heard the hum. And this was a really big thing. It was in all the major papers at the time. People were hearing a mysterious hum, mm-hmm. and it was supposedly hurting their health. And it was things like fatigue, insomnia, ringing in their ears, headaches, dizziness, just like people are reporting now. And there were rumors that it was the U.S. military doing some kind of secret testing. And there were over 90 residents of Kokomo, Indiana, that reported these symptoms. And they'd done, there was a local guy there that had done some tests, and he claimed he had heard this noise and recorded it. And they had the head of the Acoustical Society of America had listened to it, and he said at the time, he said, it could be anything. I mean, it's just some kind of noise that they picked up. In the early 90s in Taos, New Mexico, they had the Taos hum. In England, there's been a number of different hums as well. And this has kind of waxed and waned over time, and it's kind of been forgotten. But when you go back in time, you can trace these hum scares going back to the 1940s. And it's very similar stuff. There's some kind of secret weapon that's been developed. There are these vague symptoms. It's happening in people's homes. And really, it's, to me, it's the equivalent of Bigfoot and UFOs. It's very vague stuff.
Okay, so I can understand, yeah, like in Kokomo or places like that, somebody hears something, they think it feels sick. Other people say, yeah, the same thing. And so it builds. But if we've got diplomats in Cuba, so people that, you know, I would assume kind of are not mentally unstable, because, you know, when you hear about the UFO things or things like that, you start thinking, well, are these people stable? Things like that. So assuming we've got diplomats that are stable, things like that, explain to me how it becomes... Explain to me the theory of mass hysteria, because I could understand that, like, you're like, well, they're just feeling things, but why would a bunch of different people report this? Is it because they're hearing it from one another and then thinking that? Is it just coincidence that 22 people reported some sort of symptoms?
Here's what I think has happened. There's a backdrop to this, and all cases of mass hysteria, mass psychogenic illness, they don't occur in a vacuum. There's always some kind of backdrop, a context. And the context here is that during the Cold War years, and even when we had a presence in Cuba, not a strong presence, but diplomats in there in the 2000s, there were stories of Cuban agents harassing American diplomats in Cuba. It's famous among CIA folklore, and it actually happened where they, when the diplomats were at the embassy, they'd sneak into their house and they would turn books in their bookcases backwards just to let them know they were there and that, you know, someone's watching them. Occasionally it would get a bit more escalated. They might put dog poo on the floor, something like that. They would follow them as they're driving through the city, and they would follow their car and kind of cut them off so they would have a harder time driving. But pretty minor stuff overall. Nothing so malicious that, you know, that threatened their life or anything. And so this is well known in CIA folklore. And so when the diplomats went back to Cuba, once they reopened relations and established relations again, everybody was well aware of this. And I think you had a small group of people reporting some symptoms, and they're aware of this history, and they're thinking, well, maybe there's something going on here. Maybe they've done something to the water. Maybe they're doing something to the air. And then somebody heard a noise and felt unwell, and it started. And then it kind of takes on a life of its own, and it snowballs. And I think that's what's happened in this case. And you have to remember, the first cases supposedly occurred in December, but they didn't really get reported until February. And the first cases occurred, in late November. And then they got reported in the news in February. Well, that's after the Trump administration got elected, and then they took office. And the Trump administration has a history of conspiracy theories and reading into things that aren't necessarily there. And I think that's what's happened here, because they're coming out and they're saying things like, well, we're not really sure what's caused this. And we're not really sure if it's the Cubans or not, although we pulled some diplomats from the embassy because they're not keeping us safe. Well, if you're really not sure, how come you're saying it's some kind of sonic device?
Yeah. Yeah, so it's just so interesting. So, you know, I'm reading the article where, you know, and they quote you and other people that say, you know, it's a hot Trump's. And I don't want to blame that. I don't want to sound like, because you said, you know, you're not a black helicopter guy. But here we are saying, well, Trump takes over and now this is happening. But the theory is that let's try not to blame the administration at all, but just say that. Barack Obama reopens the embassy, starts establishing friendly relationships. The administration that takes over would not have probably done that, has more tough line stance on Cuba, is thinking about closing things back down and pulling out, things like that. So the theory is that now it becomes a little more of a difficult working situation for the diplomats that are there. Now things are tense again. There's some stress there. And so maybe that leads to a high anxiety working environment where something could trigger something and suddenly people start feeling unwell, maybe because they're more stressed out about their job than ever before and their working situation. And that triggers this type of thing, possibly.
Well, that sounds like something I could have said. I mean, that's exactly right. You always have some type of stressor in situations like this. And look, there was a famous case in Europe in June of 1999, and there were some students, and it relates to this, there were some students at a school in Bornem, Belgium, and a student walked up to a Coca-Cola machine and got a can of Coca-Cola, and he started to drink it, and he said, it smells a bit funny, and it's really fizzy, and then he felt unwell, and he went to the nurse, and the nurse went around the school from room to room. This was an elementary school. And said, has anybody drank Coke from the machine here? And do you feel unwell? Well, you can imagine a whole bunch of students then suddenly felt unwell. They took them to the hospital. There was absolutely nothing wrong with them. And they had, over the next several weeks, They had nearly 1,000 reports of people drinking Coca-Cola and Coke products and feeling unwell and being rushed to the hospital. Coca-Cola was banned in Belgium in the summer of 1999. They lost $250 million from that, and they also had some cases in France as well from this. And as it turned out, the what had happened was the Coca-Cola company didn't want to give up the secret recipe they had. So they said, well, look, we'll look at it ourselves. And they looked, and they found that on the Coke, outside of the Coke cans, some fungicide, anti-fungicide chemical had rubbed off the pallets and got on the Coke cans, and they blamed it on that. And the Belgian government did their own study, and they said, no, that's in parts per billion, and it couldn't possibly have caused these symptoms. And the conclusion was it was mass psychogenic illness. That was the conclusion of the Belgian government when they did their very thorough investigation on that. And really, it's the power of the mind. If somebody came to the studio right now and handed you a can of Coke and you started drinking it, and then somebody else started to read the news and said, oh, there's a Coca-Cola scare where it's allegedly been poisoned. Well, you might start to vomit and probably feel nauseous and might get a headache, but there's nothing wrong with you. And, you know, it's the power of the mind. It's like being in a house at night and it's midnight and you hear a noise and all of a sudden you're scared. But if it's broad daylight, there's no problem.
Well, here's my correlation to it, Robert. Whenever the expiration date on the milk hits, at 11:30 at night, I could have a bowl of cereal. But at 12:15 a.m., if I open the fridge and the milk has expired now on the date it's on, I will open up that milk and smell it, and it will smell rancid as could be to me. It's the moment that that date hits. And I know it's still good for a week or two or whatever, but to me, milk smells rotten whenever the moment strikes that the date on the milk hits. And I'm sure that can't be real.
That's a very good observation. And, you know, I can't let the interview go by without, and I don't know if you're aware of it or not, but Illinois is very famous in the annals of mass psychogenic illness, mass hysteria. I have a catalog I've collected over the last 20 years of about 3,000 cases. And one of the most famous cases of all occurred in Illinois in 1944. You may have heard of it. It's the famous Mad Gasser of Mattoon. Have you heard of that?
I have not. You're coming up with things, Kokomo, and I've never heard of any of these. The Mad Gasser of Mattoon. All right, explain this to us.
Well, it was these people were reporting to the police that they're being gassed at home, usually in their beds at night. Like somebody would open up the window and spray them with a noxious gas. And it was thought to be a Nazi sympathizer who had some guy had escaped in the area. This is in the area of Mattoon. And they thought he was going around spraying people with this poison gas in September of 1944. And there were at least 30 victims in this episode. It went over for several weeks. It was nausea, dry mouth, palpitations, difficulty concentrating. And the police eventually concluded that there never was a gasser. And the victims were redefining a variety of mundane events as gasser-related. Things like noticing an unusual odor at the same time your leg had fallen asleep, or a chimney flue that had been backing up, so you smell this unusual smell. And once it got... These cases, usually you have an initial sensational case that gets reported in the newspaper. Then everybody's looking for it. It's similar to UFOs in a way. There's like a big sighting, and then everybody starts searching the skies at night for evidence and seeing if it's there. And then they start redefining ever-present things as UFO-related.
Well, in a simpler term, whenever and this is maybe unrelated, but so if you start looking for a new car, so say, you know, it's what, every 10 years or so, you might start thinking about a car. And then you think, oh, you know, we really like this one van, say whatever. And then I swear for the next 2 weeks on the road, I will see that type of car over and over and over and over again. And it's there all the time, I'm sure. But suddenly it's in my mind And there I see it, left and right, left and right, left and right. Like, wow, there's thousands and thousands of these things. I never noticed this before.
That's a really good observation, because in the early 1950s, there was atomic tests going on in the Pacific. And right after a series of atomic tests, people in Washington State started noticing these little pits on their windshields that they attributed to the atomic tests. And in fact, they'd been there all along. And it was just that people were starting to notice them then, because somebody had reported it. And then now everyone's looking, instead of looking through their windshield, they're looking at their windshield.
Mm.
And it just underscores the power of the mind. You know, what's really interesting is on October 30th of 1938, they had the famous Martian invasion scare, where Orson Welles was broadcasting a play, very famous in the history of radio.
Sure.
What a lot of people don't realize is many people that night actually experienced what they heard on the radio. For example, the broadcast described these Martians using heat rays and dispersing this poison gas. Well, people actually called the police coughing and choking and saying they could smell the poison gas.
Yeah.
Other people said that they could actually feel the heat rays. People took rags and were shoving them in keyholes and underneath doors to keep the gas out. And it's a good example of the power of the human mind. There was a case back in 1978 in Rotterdam, Holland, where in a zoo, this panda had escaped, and there were over 100 sightings of the panda over the next several days all over the country. And they eventually found the panda. It was just a few hundred meters from the zoo where it had escaped, and it had been hit by a train. And they looked at it, and it's like, well, this got hit right away. It's been dead for a while.
Yeah.
So what was everybody seeing?
Yeah. Hey, Robert, we've got to take a break for the news. Can you hold on for a little bit? Are you willing to talk with us a bit longer?
Sure.
All right, excellent. Hold on one second. Robert Bartholomew, it's fascinating. There are, the more he brings it up, the more you think of different times in life where we've heard of things sort of like this. I had not heard of the Mad Gasser of Mattoon, though, I'll tell you that. Quick break in the news next, 720 WGN. Matt Bubala with you here, 720 WGN, 312-981-7200 is the call-in and text line. We're speaking with Robert Bartholomew. He's a medical sociologist living right now in South Auckland, New Zealand, and chatting with us about the, well, we started out with the sonic attacks, and then the idea of sometimes things in life aren't what we think. Sometimes there's a phenomenon, if phenomenon's the right thing to say, called a mass hysteria, where one person thinks that they saw, did, felt something, and then that kind of catches on, and other people say, yeah, I feel the same thing. I think the same thing. Robert, I keep coming up with correlations here that you've been very kind as to say they make sense. I don't know if all of them do, but I do a lot of work. I have a company outside of here that syndicates a pet radio show. So I work with a lot of pet companies, and Lyme disease in dogs is a real big thing. And we've been working a lot on Lyme issues. And Lyme, as you're probably well aware, here in America, is a big issue with the disease. But there's a ton of controversy in human health about Lyme disease and whether or not there really are these people suffering from, quote, chronic Lyme disease. And when I delved into this on the animal side and tried to bring in human health, it really became difficult because the doctors were there's a very divisive area here about Lyme disease in the States. And I was speaking with one doctor who works with pediatric issues, and she explained it to me as, you know, we don't have the science to figure out exactly what's going on with Lyme disease, but she said, but here's what happens. 40-year-old Americans get a tick. They think they have Lyme disease, so a doctor gives them antibiotics, and suddenly they feel better. And she says, Matt, as a 40-year-old man, if I give you antibiotics, you're going to feel better. You've got swollen joints, you've got achiness, you've got all these different things going on. And so they feel that a lot of people just, when doctor prescribes antibiotics, suddenly you feel better. Oh, I'm cured, or it was treated, or I don't have this anymore, or I get off of it, and then, oh, I have that again. So there's this big concern. And I wonder if that's sort of like the same thing where we think we feel things, and so we assign it to something, when sometimes it's just, part of life, or you're older, or there's other explanations that we don't want to accept.
Exactly. And, you know, in the mass hysteria literature, mass psychogenic illness, they have this category. It's a fairly rare category. It's called mass hysteria by proxy. And there have been a number of cases like this. When you mention the dogs and pets and stuff like that, there have been a number of cases. One in particular I'm thinking of near Atlanta in Georgia, where at a school, an elementary school, kids had like dark circles under their eyes and were fatigued and having trouble sleeping. And the parents diagnosed them as that there was something wrong with the school. It was a sick school. There was a sick building, and there was some agent in that building that needed to be found. They conducted all these tests. They couldn't find anything. And it wasn't the kids who were saying they were unwell. It was the parents. And there have been a few cases like that, but with pets, the dogs can't tell you that they have a tick. It comes down to the owner, doesn't it?
Well, it does. And, you know, the funny thing is in pets, there's a vaccine for Lyme disease. And you're right. It's much tougher in pets to see whether they're lethargic or not, or things like that. But it's interesting, you know, the guy I do the pet show with, we talk about, you know, it's a big thing sometimes in pets now to offer acupuncture. And I think there's a lot of controversy around acupuncture. Like, does it really do anything or not? Or do you just think it does something? And he says, it's interesting, this thought that, you know, pets aren't going to think, oh, I had this procedure, I feel better. So if there's a pet who has back pain or is walking gingerly or doing all these different things, and then you try acupuncture, and then they're walking and doing things better, you know, seem to be relieved of those symptoms, is it a better indicator that maybe that actually works, because pets aren't going to think about it in the same way that you or I would, where we, oh, boy, I really do feel better, and maybe it is all just psychosomatic.
Yeah, you know, it reminds me of, Lourdes, over in Europe and Fatima and places like that, you have people that go there to get healed. And there's a common saying, I think it's at Lourdes, where there's a whole pile of crutches where people have gone there on crutches and even some wheelchairs, and they left the wheelchair there and walked away. And the saying is, you see a lot of crutches in wheelchairs, but you don't see any wooden legs. And I mean, it's because I've seen this. I've seen a number of years ago at university, this faith healer came to the university, and there was a girl there who had long suffered from this back pain, and she couldn't reach down and touch the floor. And she came up and she touched the Bible, and they prayed together, and she was able to touch the floor, and it was stunning. And 2 weeks later, she wasn't able to touch the floor again. But, I mean, at that time, and I think, you know, who knows, maybe there is a God, and in maybe there was some kind of miraculous event that was occurring there. But it seemed to be temporary in terms of that person's case. My brother, who happens to be a Bigfoot researcher in upstate New York, and I'm a sympathetic skeptic, I don't believe in any of it, but he...
That's got to be really weird for you as somebody who's debunking all this stuff to be like, yeah, well, my brother, he's researching Bigfoot.
Makes for interesting dinner conversations.
This is why you're in New Zealand, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, he was recently on that TV show Finding Bigfoot. And
oh, my God, my kids like watching that stuff. Yeah, well, because then the series would have to end.
Yeah. Well, my favorite's the Ancient Aliens one there, where the ancient alien theorists believe. And I don't mean to make fun of them, but it's so vague and so speculative. But anyway, my brother Paul, about 3 years ago, was perfectly healthy, went to the dentist and had a tooth pulled. And within a few hours, he was in the hospital thinking he was having a heart attack. And they could find nothing wrong with him. And then he starts Googling online, you know, tooth pulled, heart issue, and, you know, there are a cluster of cases around this. And they eventually told him, go see a psychiatrist, because they said, there's nothing wrong with you. We think it's anxiety from having your tooth pulled, and it just kind of tipped you over the edge, and you're having heart palpitations and things like this. Well, eventually, he got tested for Lyme disease. And he believed that he was bitten by a tick, and he went through this treatment with antibiotics and stuff like that. But the interesting thing with that, and you brought this up,
yeah,
was that the problem with this is diagnosing it, because the tests for Lyme disease aren't very accurate,
right.
Are they?
No, not in human health.
No, not in humans, and it's a real problem. You can test. He tested negative, so they did another test, and then he tested positive. You know, what if he took another one, probably test negative again? And, you know, was the positive one accurate? I don't know. And whenever you have situations like this where there's ambiguity around health issues, there are all sorts of psychological things that can creep in there.
Yeah, and it really is interesting with the human health, because we were doing this thing on the pet health side, and we wanted to bring in human health because the idea was, you know, just an awareness thing. Because, you know, if you're out rolling around with your dog in the woods or playing in the backyard, things like that, if you find a tick on your dog, and your kids were on the other end of the leash, then it was kind of like a campaign to raise awareness about checking for these things. If your dog has a tick, you should, you know, and to get veterinarians, if they find that your dog has a tick or Lyme disease, to talk to you about, you know, checking yourself, because if you're out in the same places as your dog, you were in a high tick area, maybe, you know, it's we're all about prevention. And when we approached human health about it, we got a lot of pushback, because some of the people with a respected organization were like, listen, what's going to happen is people are going to run to the doctor and demand antibiotics. And they're so concerned about, we're over prescribing antibiotics. We don't want to push people to ask for antibiotics when it's not necessary. That most people, you know, that there's doctors that are just pushing antibiotics as this cure for Lyme disease, when Lyme disease might not even be there, might, you know, it's not in all cases and the testing and everything else. So we got all this pushback like, hey, we don't want to raise more awareness of this because we don't want people asking for antibiotics more than they already do.
Yeah. And you know, when you talk about that and the ambiguity of symptoms, I think most of your listeners can empathize with being in elementary school or possibly even high school, and some kid in the classroom has been identified as having ticks in their hair.
Lice.
And head lice.
Yes.
And
you,
well,
start itching. And
within a few minutes,
just as you said that, my hair starts itching as soon as the word comes up. As soon as you start telling that story, I knew where you were going, and my head starts itching immediately.
Yeah, exactly. And it's so easy to do because you become a bit anxious.
Yeah.
And then it's just like you've been outside or something playing sports. You come inside, and then you start feeling a bit sweaty, and you feel like something's crawling on your skin and things like that.
With, you know, when you're talking about, so with things like conspiracy theories, whether it's JFK or 9/11 or different things like that, do you believe that most of that stems from somebody who's sort of, is that sort of a mass hysteria thing too, where people say one thing and then we just glom onto that because of whatever reason, maybe because we're distrusting or we're looking for a reason for something that can't be explained? Is that a lot of what happens with things like that?
There's a big will to believe there. There's mass hysteria, and then there's social delusions. Not delusions in the psychiatric sense, but social delusions where large groups of people believe in something that's not true, like the satanic cult scare of the 1980s and 90s, where kids were supposedly being ritually abused by satanic cultists running daycare centers. The number of people were falsely accused and spent years in prison from that scare alone. But there's a lot of episodes out there, but there's no illness involved, because that would be mass psychogenic illness, aka mass hysteria. These are social delusions. I always say, when you hear the sounds of hoofbeats in the night, first think horses, not zebras. But this happens, and these scares, these panics sweep whole countries at a time.
I imagine the Salem witch hunts would have been the same type of thing. Is people start thinking one thing, it spreads around, it becomes a rumor, and then people just glom onto it?
Yeah, and you know, I have to say this. Good history speaks to the present day, in present day events. And if you go back to 1691 to 1693 in the Massachusetts Bay Colony in what is now Salem, Danvers, Massachusetts, the events that happened there, the first people who were accused, they were women who stood out because they were different. One woman smoked a pipe and she played shuffleboard late at night with young people. Another one ran a tavern. Another one was a Barbados slave woman named Tituba. And she was the person who actually triggered the beginning of the episode, the first case. Mm. These people were scapegoats. And I cannot help but think that this is an important lesson for even what's going on today. And look, when they had the satanic cult scare of the 80s and 90s and all these people were being falsely accused at daycare centers, it's one of the worst crimes imaginable is for a child to be molested. But there is an even worse crime, and that is for somebody to be falsely accused of having been molested. You know, there was a study that was done a number of years ago. It used to be in the early 80s that psychologists thought that the best eyewitnesses were children because they didn't have preconceived notions and they're just going to say what they saw. Mm-hmm. The problem is they didn't realize that they want to please the people they're talking to and older adults. But there was an interesting study done a number of years ago when all this controversy was going on in the daycare centers, and they took a year 7 or 8 classroom, and they hooked cameras up in the classroom, and they had this guy come in, and he walked over, and he said, "Oh, hi, how are you, Johnny?" And he touched him on the shoulder, walked over, shook somebody's hand, and then patted somebody in the head, and then about 10 minutes later, he walked away. And they waited several days, and then they interviewed the kids as to what happened, and nothing unusual. And then they said, "Okay, Tommy, did that man who came here, did he touch you here? Did he touch you inappropriately?" "He did, didn't he?" And Tommy's like, "Yep, yes, he did." And it's so easy for children to be led astray by leading questions because they want to please the interviewer and they're older, it's a power situation. And they didn't really realize that in the early 80s, but they do now. And I mean, there was a couple who from Texas who I did a radio interview for the national radio here in New Zealand a few weeks ago on this. They were just recently released after having spent over 20 years in prison, and it was concluded that they were innocent.
That's terrifying. Real quick here, because we have to go in a second, Robert, but psychics. So you were talking about how, you know...
I knew you were going to bring that up.
Because my guess is that you're going to say that psychics figure out a way to get you to talk to you about something that's going to pique your interest or something that you're going to want to hear about. You want to believe what they're saying. And so we end up believing what they're saying or... You know, explain to me your theory on psychics.
Well, look, I want to believe. However, let's say there was psychic ability. How does that work? I mean, we have a brain, we have ears, and the organs there are very clear as to this is for hearing. We have the eyes that go back into the brain. How would we have the sixth sense in our brain? How does that develop? I mean, it's such a complicated thing to know something that is... before it even happens. I'm a sympathetic skeptic. I want to believe. If psychics are real, how come you don't see in the newspaper another psychic banned from casino? Psychic wins lottery again. Who predicted September 11th? Nobody that I'm aware of. There is a registry in New York City called the Central Premonitions Registry where people send in predictions. Mm-hmm. And nobody had predicted that. There were a number of predictions that the space shuttle was going to explode when it did, the Challenger. However, what NASA said was, we get letters before every space shuttle launch, sure. And we have even for the Apollo missions. So yeah, I wrote a book called American Hauntings, which looks at famous movies about, like, The Exorcist and Haunting in Connecticut, The Conjuring. And when you look at the evidence of the so-called best cases, I mean, I want to believe that there's psychic phenomena and that we can predict the future, but the evidence just isn't there. I mean, as Carl Sagan once said, wherever we have strong emotions, we're liable to fool ourselves. So we have to be very careful.
Interesting. Robert Bartholomew, an American-born medical sociologist living in South Auckland, New Zealand right now. When do you come back for the holidays? Will Thanksgiving, will you be catching up on Bigfoot with your brother, or what are your plans?
Well, I'm waiting. I just tell my brother, you know, when they find the body, let me know. But, I mean, I have all these episodes, and they still haven't found it yet. Look, I don't make fun of them. It's just that, you know, they're honest, sincere people. Most people are honest, sincere people that see Bigfoot or UFOs. But most UFOs are lights in the night.
Yeah.
You know, they're redefining ambiguous phenomena relative to what they expect to see. 100 years ago, they'd be fairy lights.
Yeah, until the idea of a UFO was presented, right? Until, yeah, nobody ever thought it's somebody from another planet until that idea was put into our heads, probably.
They did a Gallup poll in the late 1940s, right after they had the flying saucer wave of 1947. And they found that 99% of the people, when they asked them open-ended question, did not consider flying saucers to be of an extraterrestrial origin. It was assumed it was some type of secret weapon, government weapon, either the United States or a foreign weapon.
Yeah.
Less than 1% thought it was extraterrestrial. Times have changed.
Yeah, no kidding. No kidding. Robert Bartholomew, thank you so much for jumping on the phone. It was fun. I hope we do it again soon.
Okay, it was a lot of fun. Take care.
All right, hold on. Just want to say goodbye to you before we go away. We'll take a quick break for some spots, and then we'll catch up on the news with David Jennings next, 720 WGN. Matt Babala here with you, 720 WGN, 312-981-7200 is the number if you want to call in and say hello. You're more than welcome to do so. We'd be happy to hear from you, of course. Somebody sent this to me earlier. Now I can't find it on Facebook, but they also texted it. So the Anne Frank costume we were talking about earlier has not truly been pulled from the shelves. It's been retitled. It's called World War II Evacuee Girl. There's actually, it's just a like a beret and a simple sweater and skirt, but there's actually a costume pitched as a World War II evacuee. That was the Anne Frank costume. They took the name Anne Frank off of it. It's still out there. Why you would wear that for Halloween, I have no idea. A sexy minion makes more sense to me, and sexy minions don't make much sense at all. Did you see the KFC story this week, David?
What story?
Kentucky Fried Chicken. Somebody, an eagle-eyed Twitter follower of Kentucky Fried Chicken, noticed that Kentucky Fried Chicken, on their Twitter account, only follows 11 people.
Oh, okay. Yes. I know what it is. Yeah, I did see that.
They follow
Herb and spices.
Yes, they follow the 11 herbs and spices that are famously in the secret KFC recipe, right? Made up of 11 herbs and spices.
And I think there is a journalist who turned out to be one of the herbs that's being followed.
Let's see. We have, so all five Spice Girls, they're following Jerry, Melanie Brown, Emma Bunton, Melanie C., and Victoria Beckham. Then they're following Herb Scribner. He is a staff writer and in-depth web producer for At Desert News. I don't know where I report on everything, originally from Massachusetts. So Desert News probably in Arizona somewhere, or Nevada, I'm guessing. Herb Wesson Jr., L.A. City Council President. Herb Waters. Herb Dean, a certified trainer, referee, and martial artist. Herb Sendak, official Twitter of Santa Clara University head coach Herb Sendak. And Herb Albert. Would that be Herb Albert in the Tijuana Brass?
The only one.
So, 11 herbs and spices for KFC. Well played. Well played, KFC. Good for them. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We will chat with somebody about the lack of airline pilots and the desperate need for them coming up after the 4:30 news. I did want to talk a little bit about the whole kerfluffle with President Trump and the, I'm not here to bash the president. Not a big fan of the president. Not happy with a lot of the stuff the president has done. And everybody gets mad. Oh, you're just bashing. You're just this. The media is this. The media is that. The media is not anything. In so many of these instances, it is the president or Sarah Huckabee Sanders or people almost forcing the media to even be harder on them. So the president had not said anything about these military members who died in Niger for almost, I think it was 12 days after, and he was finally asked about it by a reporter. And instead of just saying something simple as, it was terrible what happened there, we're still investigating everything that happened, I'm reaching out to the families, and it's a terrible tragedy, blah, 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 and just leaving it at that, which he could have done. Could have so easily just done that. Instead, goes on and on about how he likes to call and write, and a lot of the previous presidents, they didn't do that, but when appropriate, I like to call and write. A lot of guys just didn't write or didn't, blah, 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 blah. And so then that created some upset people with previous presidents, both Republican and Democrat. And so then you've got those people reach out and slash him back. And so then he says, well, hey, ask John Kelly about it. Obama didn't call him. Well, John Kelly has pretty famously never really spoken publicly about his son who died serving in the military. And so President Trump forces Kelly into an awkward situation. Then the phone. So then he's out making the phone calls. And a congresswoman who was with the family when they received the call said he made an insensitive call. And what he said was insensitive, that he said that, well, I guess he knew what he was signing up for, but I imagine it's still hard, something like that. She heard it on speakerphone. She went public saying it was insensitive and terrible. And so then President Trump fought back and said, that's a lie and I can prove it. I didn't say those things. And then basically the confusing thing is then his own people, John Kelly, is saying that, well, I told him to say those things and here's what he was trying to say. So then they make it sound like, well, he did say those things. It just didn't necessarily come out right. And I think there's some fault on both sides here. I don't like that the congresswoman went public with him doing this. He didn't call to make them feel bad. He didn't call to purposely disrespect a fallen service member. I don't believe that he did that. If it was a very awkwardly or badly handled phone call, then that's a shame. And the representative, the congresswoman, should have spoken to somebody in Trump's office or spoken to somebody with his team to say, hey, this was not handled well. You made these people more upset. If he's going to call these people, he's got to be more careful with what he says. Instead, she went public. And so I do hold her accountable somewhat for that. I don't know that these should be sacred calls, as John Kelly said, that shouldn't be talked about, that shouldn't be whatever, whatever. But I don't think she needed to go public as if he was calling the person to, you know, to make them purposely feel worse. I'm sure that wasn't his intention. The crazy thing was John Kelly saying, well, here's what I was telling him to say, because this is, you know, that he did, he died doing what he loves, that he wanted to support, and he had all these people around him, yada, yada. Apparently, President Trump didn't handle that with quite the same style that John Kelly was hoping he was going to use. But that happens. It's not President Trump's thing. Kelly even said, I told him just to write the letters. I told him not to make the phone calls, but he wanted to, especially, and he sort of had to, right? Because he made such a big deal out of saying he wants to call when appropriate. He would not just write the letters like other people, but because he had to, you know, put that out there. So then that gets bigger and worse and worse and worse. And then while John Kelly's basically confirming this is what he said, he just didn't exactly maybe say it right, or it wasn't taken in the right way. At the same time, just, you have that audio ready of the Trump interview, Laura Trump, who is married to Eric Trump. Is this Eric's wife? Laura Trump. I don't know all the extended Trump family, but here was an interview that was done around the time this was all going on. Go ahead.
Criticized for the conversation that he had with the Gold Star widow. Yeah. What were your thoughts on that topic?
I think it's disgusting. I mean, I think it shows the absolute worst of politics. Here's the President of the United States calling to express his condolences on behalf of an incredibly grateful nation, and people turn it into a political item. And to me, it's disgusting.
You read the transcripts. What were your thoughts?
From what I've seen, this is just a clear case of the media not doing their job. Whenever you read exactly what he said, your husband went into battle, you know, knowing that he could be injured, knowing that he could be killed, and he still did it because he loves this country and he did it for the American people. I can't think of a better way, quite frankly, to express my gratitude to someone than by saying something like that. And yet they conveniently leave off the last part of what was said. This man is a hero. There are no two ways about it. My father-in-law is the biggest champion of the military there is. And you know, we all in this country love and respect our military, and no one more so than the president.
And I wouldn't argue with that. I wouldn't argue that he loves the military and appreciates what they do. And I very much imagine that President Trump has realized the gravity of what he's in charge of. I'm going to give him that. I know a lot of people would probably disagree with that. But I will say that I imagine you become president and it's a very heavy weight on your shoulders, and you realize, you know, what people are doing at your beck and call. The problem with that is she asked, now the journalist is the one who says, you read the transcripts. She puts those words in her mouth. Now, maybe because off air, they said, well, I read the transcripts. And so that led her to ask that question. Lara Trump never says, well, when I read the transcripts, but she does say, when you read the exact words, sounding like she's read the exact words. The problem is then later in the day, Sarah Huckabee Sanders is asked about it, and she said there was no transcript of that call. She's talking about what she saw reported. So there is no transcript, but they're acting like there was a transcript. And here's exactly what he said. So it just gets messier and messier, and they keep, and you know, Sarah Huckabee Sanders saying it's improper to question a retired four-star general and all these things. They just make it, you know, they love to paint the media as these terrible people just want to report terrible things and make up lies, fake news, fake media. But here's the Trumps, you know, spreading fake news, which happens all the time. They want to accuse one way, but then they do it themselves. Her saying there was a transcript and here's exactly what he said, when that's not true. It's just a mess. And I'll be honest, the Democrats didn't help it on this one, because there should have never been public call out on what was said in that call. If he handled it badly, if it was improperly done, then she should have, you know, spoken to somebody within the administration to say, hey, you're making this worse with that phone call. Come on, you have to be better than that. But calling the administration out publicly when there's so much else already going on, I don't think helps anything at all. 312-981-7200. Matt Bubala with you here on 720. Matt Bubala here with you on a beautiful Saturday morning on Michigan Avenue. We're live from the Allstate Showcase Studio in the historic Tribune Tower here on Michigan Avenue. We're just south of us. The brand new Apple store just opened on Friday during the day. And there's a lot of pictures of it in the paper. Blair Kamen gave it a beautiful review in your Chicago Tribune, saying it reinvigorates the river area here, the Riverwalk area. So that will be exciting to see and check out sometime soon. Texter from 815 says, so read us the transcript. Well, that's the problem. There is no actual transcript. There is no transcript. When they were talking about reading the transcript, that's not true. She just apparently had read reports about what was said on the phone call. And I don't know if there was things made up when she said that, or if she had read things that she thought were officially part of a transcript. We don't know. We don't know. But what we do know is Sarah Huckabee Sanders then said there is no official transcript. So make what you will of that. 312-981-7200. We got a call coming in here. Who do we have here? Who is this? As Jess gets them up on the line, it's Joe. Hey, Joe, you're on 720 WGN. Good morning.
Matt, let me congratulate you on a superb overall assessment of that entire situation regarding the president's call to our Red Star family.
Gold Star family, isn't it? You said red star. It's a gold star family, right?
Well, I put them in the gold category. They call it red, but, you know, I'm just upgrading them, if you will.
Oh, okay. They call them red star families? I've only heard gold star families.
Whatever.
Okay. Okay. Neither here nor there. Go ahead, Joe.
But whatever. You just dissected it very nicely, if you will.
Thank you.
You know, good, bad, and the ugly. Why would the president take time out of his day to call a family to personally, you know, try to, you know, discourage them? I think it's impossible, and you made that point quite adequately. The one question I really have, because I listened to you and I sincerely say you did a superb job, why was there a congressman present?
Congressperson.
Now I correct you.
Sure. So here's the background on that, because people have been upset about that. Congresswoman was very close, from what I've read, the congresswoman was very close to the family.
Yep.
And was a mentor to the soldier who died. And I believe at the time of the call, they were
all together in the car.
And they were traveling to, I believe, to the airport to retrieve his body, right?
I don't know if that, I don't
Maybe
know
I'm wrong
that
about
part
that.
Of it, but they were, but they were the all congresswoman
car,
was,
call,
they were all in the
together.
Same car.
Now, the widow apparently took the call on speakerphone. Maybe she should have just done that privately. I'm not going to question how a widow is handling anything
sure.
in that moment, because
exactly.
nobody wants to be in that situation.
Right.
But apparently she overheard some of the call. Now, could the representative have also, the congresswoman, somewhat mischaracterized the call? It's based on her emotion from what she heard. And like you said, and I completely agree, I don't believe that the president called with any ill intention.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we all know President Trump. From his time in office, he's not always, he doesn't possess necessarily the social graces that we all might like.
Precisely.
He's not the person I would think of as being the friend that calls you, that really lifts you up when things are down. That's just not who he is. And unfortunately, it's one of the demands of the presidency is that you have to handle things like that. But his own guy said, don't make the calls, write the letters. It's going to be better. And unfortunately, this happened.
Yeah, I think the message that he was given by his, you know, four-star general, Marine, okay, was dead nuts on. He's been there, you know, numerous times. He said, don't make the call, you know. He advised him not to. But nevertheless, his suggestion was dead nuts on. He was with his compatriots, his brothers. He was doing what he wanted to do, and that's the message he tried to convey to the president. And I agree he might not have conveyed that message as, you know, diplomatically and as, you know, suavely as could have been done.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, he had the right intentions, if you will. So I think that, you know, the way this has been blown out of proportion is totally out of sync.
Yeah.
So my compliments to you again for looking at the situation and assessing all the various implications.
I appreciate that, Joe. Thank you so much. You have a wonderful morning and a wonderful weekend as well. 312-981-7200. News coming up, 720 WGN. Matt Bubala here with you on 720 WGN. About 25 minutes left in the show this morning. Good morning, everybody. Thanks very much for being with us here on the show. If you missed anything tonight, it will be podcast up at WGNradio.com. You can follow us on Facebook at The Matt Bubala Show. I did post that PSA spot we were talking about earlier that Burger King created, the anti-bullying spot. That is pretty fascinating and well worth your time. So take a look at that when you get a chance. Give us a like at The Matt Bubala Show on Facebook. Colonel Marty Reynolds is jumping on the phone with us right now. He's a retired U.S. Air Force commander. He is a military fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Good morning, Marty. How are you, sir?
Hey, Matt. Thanks for having me on. How are you doing today?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm great. Thanks very much for jumping on the phone with us at this early hour. There is a huge pilot shortage coming up. I actually did a story about this earlier this week here on WGN Radio because we have a high school, an Air Force Academy high school here in Chicago down by Comiskey Park where the White Sox play that just got 7 new flight simulators to help kids train to possibly go into the Air Force and become pilots down the road because we read that over the next 20 years, commercial airlines are going to need to hire 600,000 pilots, which seems like an insane number. Is that accurate, though? Is that how big the shortage, looming shortage is?
Yeah, Boeing has they do a study every year, and that 600,000 number is really kind of a global number. So here in the United States, they're predicting that the North American market will require about 117,000. But if you look at Europe and Asia, they're looking for 234,000. So even though there's a shortage here in the United States, and clearly in the Air Force there's a shortage as well, you can see that the shortage is going to be a global problem, not just here in the United States.
President Trump signed a while back an executive order allowing the Air Force to bring back to active duty 1,000 pilots to address the shortage. There are about 1,500 pilots short just in the Air Force, right? Are we short pilots in the other armed service branches as well?
Yeah, well, I think they're struggling with their own retention challenges as well. I think it's most acute right now in the Air Force. But the executive order that President Trump signed actually gives the Air Force, the Department of Defense, some flexibility to bring back on a volunteer basis retirees to fill key staff positions. So that was just signed, I think it was yesterday. And so we're waiting for the Secretary of Defense to actually provide some guidance to the services on how you could actually bring those folks back and in what conditions.
But
so
again,
from the Air Force perspective.
But again, that's, you said the word voluntary. So they can, if the government says we want you back, they can decline?
Yeah, I think what, and this just came out yesterday, I'm still waiting for the guidance from the Secretary of Defense, but everything I've read, it's a volunteer program. So it doesn't appear as it's going to be a mandatory, like you're going to get a letter in the note in the news and, hey, you retired, now you're going to come back.
That would be a tough letter to get, wouldn't it?
Oh, yes, it would. And I know in the beginning you said I'm retired. I'm still on active duty, so I'm not expecting to get those letters soon. So they still have me. But you know, you can imagine if you know getting a letter in the mail like that. But the challenge is statutorily that you could only bring back 25 retirees per service.
Mm-hmm.
And given the fact that we have 1,500 positions right now that are vacant, and most of these are staff positions too.
So it's not necessarily pilots that they need exactly. It's you, when you say staff positions, does that mean not in need of flying actual planes?
Right. So what happens is we've got a number of positions, obviously, that we've got to fill with folks to fly. And then there's other positions that you need that acute experience to fill key staff positions so that you can make informed decisions, provide guidance, and really essentially do the command and control for the Air Force. But those positions right now, we're not filling them because we just don't have the folks to fill them. So our primary responsibility is to get airplanes off the ground, do training and all that. So we fill our flying wings and flying squadrons with folks at the disadvantage of staffs who don't have the personnel to fill these key positions. So what we're asking to do is say, hey, can we bring some volunteers to fill those key positions? It's just kind of a nice offset so that we can continue to do our mission.
Are there actual pilots that would be brought out of retirement? And how tough is that if you were a pilot, had retired from the Air Force for say, 3 to 5 years already, and then to be asked to come back and fly the planes again? I imagine there's a lot of training that goes back. Once you stop doing that for a few years, those type of planes, I imagine it's tough to jump right back into that.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Everything I've seen at this point, the folks that they would bring back would be primarily just for staff assignments and not flying, just for the reasons you just said. I mean, it's a expensive proposition to bring people back. You got to send them back to training again, recurrent. Some, you know, may not have any recency, currency. So it sounds like as if they're going to bring them all back and just put them in staff positions.
Okay, well, that makes sense. So the overall pilot demand, though, is going to be very strong over the next couple of decades. And you wrote about this in a piece that we got. I think it was in Fortune Online.
It was, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
yeah. It's pretty surprising to read how tough the pay is when you start out as a pilot. I guess in part because it's maybe decent pay for a starting job, but because that you spend so much money, most pilots do, to achieve their rating to get their license. Are airlines going to be offering great incentives to get more pilots then so that people aren't carrying? Is it sort of a big student loan type situation where pilots are going into great debt to become pilots and then not making enough money to make it worthwhile to go into the to that profession?
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. I think there's a combination of things. So in terms of pay, right now, if you look at industry standards, it's anywhere from $20,000 to $30,000 per year that the folks make in their first few years with a regional airline. To actually get your licensing, to go through and get a pilot license, and then all the way to the point where you can fly on a commercial airline, you need to crew hours too. So in 2009, there was an accident in Buffalo, and that precipitated some changes in the number of hours that pilots needed to be able to do commercial flying. So it went from 250 hours all the way up to 1,500 hours, which is a pretty significant jump. So to get to the point where you have the hours and the licensing, you know, the estimates are if you do it out of pocket, that could cost anywhere up to $150,000. So if you're making a value judgment and saying, I'm going to put in this time and effort to not just, you know, spend the $150,000, spend the time to get to that point, and then have a job where you're only making $20,000 to $30,000. And then you have the other pieces that go with it as well. You know, the stresses that go with it, hours away from home and everything else. What we're finding is that the younger folks or the folks that are considering aviation are not going down that path or doing commercial flying because they're making a value judgment. So they're deciding that there's other things I can do professionally that would, you know, that the calculus is a little bit better in my favor. So that's part of the challenge is that we can't get folks interested in that. On the Air Force side, what I would tell you is that we have a lot of folks that are very interested in flying because if you join the Air Force, yes, you do have to sign up and you basically are in the Air Force for 10 years, but you get world-class training. Yeah, you don't have to pay for it. You're also making a pretty good salary through that period. Of course, you have service, so you know you have to deploy and put yourself in harm's way, and sure. You also have to move and all those other things that come with military service. So that's the supply side of it. On the demand side, though, the demand, as you just mentioned, is going through the roof. You know, this last Boeing had calculated it. About 6% increase over the last 5 years, and they're expecting growth to be about 4 to 5% over the next 20 years. The other part of this too is that for the airlines on the statutory side, they also changed the flight crew rest periods, which means that they actually have to hire more crew, not just pilots, but all the crew, so they can have the same number of flights. The other side of it too is that. And back in 2009, they changed the retirement age from 60 to 65, and we're now past that five-year point. So all the folks that could have retired back in 2009 are now retiring, and they're retiring in pretty large numbers. The estimates are anywhere from 4,000 per year to a high end of 18,000 over the next 3 years.
Wow.
So if you put all these combinations together, you've got high demand, a lot of folks leaving through retirement, and then the supply side would show that not as many people are interested in doing the commercial aviation. So what does that mean? So when I was on the council of foreign relations here, you know, the question I had is I know the Air Force had a problem and I know that nationally they're having a challenge. So I said, well, my question was like, so who's affected the most by this? The national airlines, the major airlines are actually still hiring and they're hiring at a very high rate and they don't seem to have as much of a challenge hiring. It's the regional airlines, the ones that pay a little bit less, but they're incredibly important to the transportation network. 50% of all departures in the United States are by, according to the regional association, they actually are by regional airlines. In some cases, 65% of the departures for some small market airplanes are almost all 100% regional. Mm. So this last year, just as an example, Horizon, citing pilot shortage, had to cancel hundreds of flights, which Alaska and SkyWest had to pick up. And the two other regional airlines actually filed Chapter 11, which is an indication that, and they cited also pilot shortages why they had to file bankruptcy. So when you put all these pieces together, you know, given the fact that, you know, I grew up in Montana, a small, and, you know, Billings was my airline or my the place I wanted to fly out of. Yeah, the airport. You put this together is that if you're at a regional location, and prices are generally pretty high there anyway, and there's a lot of reasons why prices are high. But if you add in the complication of less flights, then the most vulnerable right now because of the pilot shortage are those that are in the smaller markets. So it is possible. I think prices could go up. But more than anything else, you're also going to lose the possibility for flexibility because you're going to have less opportunity to fly on flights because there's less flights.
We're speaking with Marty Reynolds. He is he is on the Council on Foreign Relations. He's a colonel in the U.S. Air Force. We have to take a quick break, Marty. Hold on 1 second. We'll get some spots and a few more questions about the pilot shortage coming up, 720 WGN. A couple minutes left in the show, 4:52 in the morning. Matt Bubalik here with you, speaking with Marty Reynolds about the pilot shortage. Colonel Marty Reynolds in the U.S. Air Force, also on the Council on Foreign Relations. Marty, our newsman David Jennings has a quick question for you. Go ahead, David.
Okay.
Oh, hold on, David. There you are, sir.
Go ahead. We are. Colonel, just a couple of things real quick. Corgan Air, I know that's why they raised it. Should they consider a different approach? That is, go back to a lower minimum, let's say 500 hours, and put them through actual real-world testing, because flying is more than knowing, it's also an art, and some people have the skill and some people don't. And the second part is, any chance they will raise the retirement age from 65 to 70 for commercial pilots?
Yeah, those are two good questions. In fact, those are two questions that are being addressed both by the aviation trade agencies, and then also even on Congress, they're actually asking the same question. So let me start with the hours. So if you're a military pilot, you don't have to have the full 1,500 hours. 750 hours is enough for you to do it, and that's because the training that we get is really intense. And there's basically a lower level that you need to make that transition from military to civilian. If you have a four-year degree, then you only need 1,000. And then for all others, it's 1,500. So what I'd argue is I think there's a time to probably revisit this rule of hours. Now, there's a reason for this being in place. That's primarily for safety purposes. You know, like all of us fly on aircraft, we would like to make sure that the pilots are the best trained and have the most experience when they operate the aircraft. But I think, you know, an hour, 1,500 hours is just kind of it's just a number. It's, you know, why not 499 or, you know, 1,000 or 1,501? So there's probably other things that we can consider. And just like you just mentioned, higher end training, you know, for example, if you have more simulator time or more classroom time, can that also count towards the hour requirement? As far as the retirement goes, it's not inconceivable to see the retirement age moving above 65. You know, it could go to 67. Overseas in some places it is 67. Or it could go higher. I'm not sure where that is within Congress, but I don't think that's inconceivable. That's one of the options that's used.
Thank you, sir.
Hey, and another real quick question here is it, and we got to get going. Is it a good time then to want to be a pilot? I would assume that because of the shortage, that the airlines and the aviation industry will try to do more to offer more to incentivize kids to take aviation as majors and learn to become pilots. And also because in general, you know, these regional airlines are closing down because there's not enough pilots. That means the pilots are getting the better jobs that fly longer routes, have better pay, better benefits. So while there's the shortage, I imagine it's the best time to become a pilot because you're going to move up the ranks faster as they need more. Does that make sense?
Oh, man, absolutely. Listen, it's always a good time to be a pilot. It's amazing career. It's a lot of fun. But I think what you just mentioned, there's going to be the traditional and really innovative ways for the airlines to actually try to hire folks. And, of course, the increasing pay and benefits is one of the things that are on the table. But you got to get people to be excited about aviation. So one of the things I'm advocating in the article was, you know, is it time to actually have like a national czar of aviation where they get young folks actually really excited about flying, you know. Going to an air show, I mean, how people get very, very excited about flying and get motivated, excited about it. So, yeah, I think you're right. I think there's a perfect time to fly. And it's going to take some time, too. You know, to start flying and then accrue the hours and licensing and all that takes time for you to be eligible to fly. To change structural changes in contracts is going to take time to do that. So it's going to take some time for us to probably see the supply and demand curves work in the favor of the airlines. And then, of course, on the retention side for the Air Force, you know, we're working on programs where we would like to have our folks stay in longer. So we've actually started seeing bonuses go up, monthly flight pay go up. And then we're trying to change our own culture so people have feel even a deeper meaning and purpose about flying in the military, so they want to stay with us for a longer period. But it's going to take some time. But if you're thinking about aviation, boy, right now is a good time to do it.
Marty Reynolds, the piece is in Fortune. We'll put it up online as well. Thank you so much for jumping on the phone this morning.
Hey, Matt, thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
You bet, sir. Have a great weekend. All right. Orion Samuelson coming up with The Morning Show next here on 720 WGN.